If, you know, and if somebody has to come in, because we had to get out of bed, he wants to hear that.
All right, let's begin.
Yes.
We'll talk afterwards. Okay. Yes, this is my new toy.
Oh, okay.
What do they say? The difference in a man and a boy is the price of his toys? It's my new toy. All right. What? Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud, verse 10. We are moving right along. We are plowing through.
Someone said to me, oh, you're learning how to shoe. You must have learned such and such. And I didn't want to say where we were because I wouldn't have to explain.
We've learned, we've covered much ground.
Yes, we have.
But we haven't necessarily covered many verses. We're going to change that. It's always, the introduction to any sefer is always longer than, you know, then as you go along. So that's true, and that's true with Yeshua, it's true with Shoftim, it's true, certainly true with Shmuel. I spent, the last time I taught Shmuel, I spent half a year on during the introduction, and then we started to fly. Because once you get past all the introductory variables, then you move. So we'll do three verses today. We'll move along. Verse 10. Vayitzav Yehoshua et shotrei ha'am lemor. Yeshua now begins his service as the newly appointed leader. God, previous paragraph was all about the charge to Yeshua, the message, the encouragement, chazak v'hamatz. So now Yeshua begins his job. I guess you could say the first half is the installation, and then there's the and the real work begins. Vayitzav Yehoshua et shotrei ha'am lemor. Ivru bekerav ha'machane v'tzavu et ha'am lemor. The shotrei ha'am, who are the shotrei ha'am? The shoter is an officer. In modern Hebrew, a shoter is a police officer, but in biblical Hebrew, shoter is an officer, leader, some kind of structure related to the leadership of Bnei Yisrael. And he instructs them to go through the people and convey the following message. There's no email, there's no internet, there's no public loudspeaker. You want to get a message to everybody, you need foot soldiers. That's what the shotrim were. They were his foot soldiers. And he instructs them to tell the people, Ivru bekerav ha'machaneh, go through the camp. V'tzavu et ha'am lemor, hachinu lachem tzeda. And tell them to prepare food. Why prepare food? Ki ba'od shloshet yamim atem ovrim et hayarden hazeh. Because we're on a 3-day journey. We are moving to Israel. We are going closer to the Jordan. We are going to cross the Jordan in 3 days hence. Lavo l'reshet et ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokechem noten lachem l'mishta. To inherit the land that God has given us as an inheritance, and therefore they have to prepare themselves. They have to prepare food. Why do they need food? It's amazing. It's an amazing little three paragraphs of food. But what about food in the desert?
We all right?
They're Jewish. They all had man. they eat the man until they come into Eretz Yisrael. It's a strange concept. Tachinu lachem tzeda. Tzeda l'derech. By the way, the phrase tzeda l'derech comes from here. Tzeda l'derech is a. You don't know what the expression means? Tzeda l'derech is a modern expression in Hebrew for you travel, you take food along the way. You never travel without food. You always need tzeda l'derech, food for the journey. Snack food, real food, whatever it is. But you have to have food. You can't go without. You can't travel without food. So they're going 3 days towards the land of Israel. They can't travel without food. Yeshua's first instruction to the people, food. Army moves on its stomach. Jewish armies certainly move on their stomach. You have to have food. I just find it ironic. The focus on chinu lachem tzeda. The reality is that what he was telling them is we're on a 3-day journey. We're not stopping. So don't pack up. We're going. Not clear what would happen to the man at that point because the man was a daily routine, and they weren't stopping until they get to the edge of the Jordan and then crossing over the Jordan. And clear what the implication was vis-a-vis the man. But certainly the plan is 3 days from now, ba'od shloshet yamim, and another 3 days, we are crossing the Jordan. That is a very important comment on the timetable, because it's the key element in understanding the sequence of events. We know what day they crossed the Jordan. How do we know what day they crossed the Jordan? Take a look at chapter 4, verse 19. V'ha'am alu min ha'yarden be'asor l'chodesh harishon. People came out of the Jordan, crossed the Jordan on the 10th of the first month, which is the 10th of, what's the first month? Nisan, right? 10th of Nisan. So we know exactly when they crossed the Jordan. They crossed the Jordan on the 10th of Nisan, correct? Oh, the first thing they're going to do when they come into the land of Israel is celebrate Pesach. Exactly right. The date is not an accident. They will need 3 days to prepare for Pesach. We'll get to the whole sequence. But certainly they are, they cross the Jordan on the 10th of Nisan. If I go back 3 days, I now know how to date this transition. Correct? This transition, when is this taking place? 7th of Nisan. Because he says to them, in another 3 days, we cross the Jordan. So not only does it tell us just in general what's going on, but it is our anchor chronologically for the opening day of Sefer Yehoshua. Sefer Yehoshua begins on the 7th of Nisan. Why is that significant? So now let me show you something else. Let's give out some source pages. Let's pass those around. Show you an interesting pass them back. I'm gonna pass them back to David. Everybody have a page? Okay. From these two anchors, namely that they crossed the Jordan on the 10th of Nisan, and therefore 3 days earlier is the 7th of Nisan, the Gemara derives one of the most interesting dates in Jewish history, namely the anniversary of the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. What's the anniversary of the death of Moshe Rabbeinu? Zion Adar, 7th of Adar, which is also, by the way, supposed to be his birthday, because the Gemara says he was born and died on the same day. But the text from which the Gemara derives that date is not in the Torah. It's this verse right here. Take a look at the Gemara in Kiddushin. B'shiva ba'adar met Moshe, u'b'shiva ba'adar nolad. An assertion of the Gemara, it's a brayta that says that Moshe was born on the 7th Adar and Moshe died on the 7th Adar of Adar. Gemara starts from the assumption of the day of his death, because that's the one that's more textually supported here. How do I know that he died on the 7th of Adar? And now the Gemara quotes, just quotes Pesukim, without even having to explain them. Just walk through the sequence of events. It says Moshe died there in Arvot Moav. Uktiv says next, B'nei Yisrael mourned for Moshe for 30 days. Uktiv v'hi acharei mot Moshe eved Hashem. Immediately after the death of Moshe, God says to Yehoshua, Moshe avdimet, v'ata kum avorat ha'yaden. Get up and cross over the Jordan. Uchdiv, and it says, Yivru bekerev ha'machane v'tzivu ota'am lemor, achinu lachem tzeda, ki ba'od shloshit yamim, tavru ota'yarden. says that Moshe, that Yehoshua instructed the people, 3 days from now we cross the Jordan. The people came out of the Jordan on the 10th of the first month. So now work backwards. From the 10th of Nisan, work backwards. Go back 33 days. 3 days of the Yeshua's instruction, and 3 days we crossed the Jordan. 30 days for the mourning period of Moshe. Clearly, God was not instructing Yeshua to take over the leadership until after the 30 days of mourning for Yeshua, for Moshe was over. From here we derive that Moshe died on the 7th of Adar. It's actually a very simple calculation.
Do we know that it's chronological?
We have no reason to assume it's not. We have no reason to assume it's not. And in fact, that's why the Gemara quotes the verse, Vayhi acharei mot Moshe eved Hashem, the opening verse of Yeshua, because it links the two. It tells me that one was on the heels of the other. It's unlikely that there was any kind of delay. There certainly was no need for an election. There was no need for a year of election campaigning. They knew who the leader was going to be. And the last thing you want to do is leave the flock without a shepherd. Especially in the context of Bnei Yisrael, leaving them without a shepherd, given the nature of who and what they are and the nature of their the characters, we've seen it in the Midbar. It would have been unwise to leave them for even a moment without a shepherd. And that, in fact, was Moshe's greatest worry. Parshat Pinchas, when he turns to God and he says, Yivkod Hashem Elokei v'chot l'chol basar, ish ala ida. God, you know the flesh of every person, you know the soul of every person, appoint somebody over the people. Shelo yadat Hashem kitzon asher en lehem mo'eh. So that the flock should not be, so that the congregation of God shouldn't be like a flock without a shepherd. Those were exactly Moshe's words to request that there should be a transfer of leadership. And the whole experience of the transfer of leadership at the end of Sefer Devarim was to make sure that there would not be a day without a leader, not be a day without a transition. So Moshe dies, there's a 30-day mourning period, and certainly there's a moratorium in any kind of activity vis-a-vis moving forward till after the 30 days, out of respect to Moshe. Vayhi acharei mot Moshe eved Hashem, the Gemara assumes, is the next day after the 30 days. God instructs Yeshua, kum avor et ha-yarden, get up, it's time to move. Yeshua instructs the people, ba'od shloshit yamim, work your way backwards from the 10th of Nisan, we have the 7th of Adar. Remember that what we're trying to do here is not connect two traditions, the text and a tradition. The tradition that Moshe died on the 7th of Adar is derived from the text. Now that's the only source we have. So the question simply worked its way backwards. From the 10th of Nisan, what's 33 days? The 7th of Adar. We assume that he died on the 7th of Adar. This is the source for that tradition. The notion that he was born on the same day is not relevant to Sefer Yehoshua, but essentially it's based on a verse in Parshat Vayelech where Moshe says that, behold, I am 120 years old today. So the assumption is that if he says today, it means not just his age, but that in fact he was born on the same day that he died. Okay. Let's continue. Verse 12. That's to the people. Shotrei ha'am, he instructs. Yeshua is in management mode. So he goes to the Shotrim and he says, go tell the people 3 days and we cross the Jordan. Prepare yourselves. Verse 12. V'la'u v'ni, v'la'gadi, v'la'chatzi shevet ha'menashe. As for Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe. Who are Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe? Right, they're the 2.5 tribes that requested to inherit on the east side of the Jordan, and Moshe said, on one condition, that you fight first and then you can go back and inherit the land. So Moshe now has to prepare, Yeshua now has to prepare them for their role in the program. Amar Yeshua Lemur. Yeshua says to them, Zachor et hadavar asher tzivatchem Moshe eved Hashem. Remember what Moshe eved Hashem commanded you, saying, Hashem Elokechem miniach lachem V'natan lachem et ha'aretz hazot. God is giving you this land as an inheritance. On one condition. Nishechem, tapchem, umiknechem, yeshvu ba'aretz. Your wives, your children, your cattle, your families, your possessions, everything you leave here. Ashenatan lachem Moshe be'ever hayarden. You leave here in the land that Moshe has given you, east of the Jordan. Ve'atem, you, meaning the men, eligible fighting age, eligible conscription age, you, the soldiers, ve'atem tavru chamushim lifnei achechem. You shall cross over armed before your brethren. Remind me to come back to the word chamushim. Kol giborei achayel, all of the soldiers. Va'azartem otam, and you shall help them. Ad asher yaniach Hashem la'achechem kachem, until God will give them minucha, meaning rest, meaning success on the battlefield, from like he has given you. Your battles are over, now they have to fight their battles. V'yashu gamhema et ha'aretz asher Hashem la'achechem naten lahem. And they too will inherit the land that God has given them. V'shavtem le'eretz yirushatchem. Then you can come back to the land of your inheritance. V'yirishtem, v'yirishtem ota. And then you can inherit it. V'yirishtem ota, shenatan lechem Moshe avad Hashem be'ever ha'yardei mizrach ha'shemesh. Once you've gone over and you've fought and you've established yourself and you've protected the Bnei Yisrael and they've had respite from all of their enemies, then you can come back to your land and inherit it. Those are the instructions for Moshe, and the program is proceeding as instructed. So now Yeshua is reminding them of that commitment. They answered Yeshua and they said, "Kol asher tzivitanu na'aseh. Whatever you command us, we will listen. You are our commander in chief. Ve'el asher tishlachenu nelech. Where you send us, we shall go. K'chol asher shamanu el Moshe, kein nishma elecha. As we listen to Moshe, we will listen to you. Rak yeh Hashem elokecha imach kasher hayayim Moshe. God should be with you as he was with Moshe. We are your Lord." Essentially, he says to them, they say to Yeshua, you need not worry about us. We are yours, we are loyal, we will do what you tell us, we will do what Moshe told us. Don't worry. We are here, whatever you want. We are your foot soldiers. Kol asher, and then they went one step further. Kol ish asher yamre et picha, v'lo yishma et dvarecha, any person who will rebel against you and will not listen to your words, kol asher titzavenu, anything that you command, remember that Yeshua has the status of a king, you must. Such a person will die, we will be your front guard. Rak chazak v'yamatz. You be strong. You have courage. Go for it. Lead. We'll follow. Powerful message of confidence Reuven, Gad, and Menashe convey to Yehoshua. Message of confidence Yeshua needs and Yehoshua deserves, certainly, and he gets very loud and clear. Yeah?
In the translation, it says provided that Hashem. Is that there in Hebrew?
It says rak. That can mean any number of things. I'm not sure it's a conditional statement. I don't think
that weakens it.
It weakens it, but it doesn't match the tenor of the whole
right.
Of the whole parak. I would translate it that way. To bracha only. Rak chazak v'yamatz. Rak chazak v'yamatz. Take a look at the end of verse 18. Same word, rak. The last three words of the paragraph. Rak chazak v'yamatz. That's not provided.
Okay.
That's only. Oh. Right? Only be strong, be courageous. Only Hashem should be with you.
Right?
It's a bracha.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't...
You know what
the issue is? Let me take a moment, open a parenthesis, and talk a little bit about translations. There is no such thing as a translation that's not a commentary. I've said this before. this is a, it's a phrase that Nechama Leibowitz drilled into us 100 times. Because the moment you're dealing with a translation, it doesn't make a difference which translation. Art Scroll, Jerusalem Bible, German, all the old German translations, Buber translations, it makes no difference. There's no such thing as a translation that's not a commentary by definition. By definition, what is a commentary? It's a translation of the text according to the way you understand it. And the moment there's an ambiguity in the text, you are going to have to take a position, translate it. The earliest Jewish commentaries, the earliest Mefarshim we have, were translations. Unklus is a translation. Targum is a translation. Rav Sadia Gaon, which is the earliest Gaonic parish we have, upon which Rashi sort of built his parish, is a translation. So when you sit down and translate, you have to comment. There's no way to avoid it. Now, the only question is, what are you commenting? Are you translating your own insights? Are you translating according to one of the Mefarshim, etc.? And here, there are different philosophies of translations. The Art School translation of Tanakh as a whole, with one exception, took a position that it was going to try to translate in accordance with Rashi's understanding of the text as much as possible. It was a philosophical position. Rashi is the pillar of Jewish commentary. They decided, and it's written in the introduction to every one of their svarim, that they will translate to the best of their ability in accordance with, because you can't translate without comment, they will translate in accordance with the position of Rashi's commentary. That the Ramban, that the Rashbam, that the Ben Ezra, and that all the Mefarshim would have different interpretations and therefore different translations, so be it. But you can't translate that text without explaining the word rak. And if Rashi translates it as one as a conditional statement, and the Radak translates it differently, you're going to have to take a stand. So to give them credit, they took a very consistent stand across the board. Whereas most commentaries are less consistent. They will look at the text and sort of translate in accordance with what they see it in that moment, how they understand it. Artscroll decided, for all kinds of reasons, to take a very consistent approach to the translation, work off Rashi's commentary from beginning of Tanakh to the end, and assume that that's where the text is ambiguous, to try to work the text translation in accordance with the tenor of Rashi's commentary. So you're going to get differences in translations no matter where you go in Tanakh. It's one of the challenges of working off a translation rather than the Hebrew, is that you're going to have a bias in your understanding because you're working off the pre-commented text rather than the text by itself that allows you to explore the various views and options. The only exception to that rule of the Art School translation was Shir HaShirim, which, for reasons that are philosophical, again, and I don't necessarily agree with them, but their Art School chose not to translate the text. They translated Rashi's commentary on the text. So when you read the English Art School translation of Shir HaShirim, you'll see that the allegory and its interpretation is built into the translation. That already is a step beyond the normal system of translation. What they essentially did was they wrote a modern Targum, because that's what Targum did. Translated and built the Midrashic interpretation of the text into the translation. So they chose, which is not without precedent, to translate in accordance with the spirit of the ancient Targumim, which built the commentary into the translation. Rather than in the rest of Tanakh, where they try to translate accurately or literally, but when this ambiguity, they resolved it through the commentary of Rashi.
Just out of curiosity, because you mentioned it, does Art Scroll and its preface to Shir HaShirim say that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a whole lengthy explanation as to why, and who they consulted, and which poskim instructed them as such, and why they did it. Nothing's left to, there's nothing misleading there. Unless you decide to skip the introduction and then just say, hey, what did they do here? Right? There's nothing misleading. That was a philosophical decision. So that's a... I digress. I'm glad I got that off my chest, so that's all right. I always need an opportunity for things like that. That's okay. All right. That's as far as the timetable. There's more to be said about the timetable, but I want to just make a couple of comments about the story of Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh before we continue. First of all, there's a word here that's very significant. And I'm just out of curiosity. How do they translate the word chamushim? The art scroll translation. Just that, since we're on the topic. It's in 14 actually. It's the end of 14. Chamushim lifnei achechem, before your brethren. Armed. Good.
Armed.
Correct. The word chamushim means armed. Now, why is that significant? Because there's a verse we just read in Parashat Bishalach, actually just last week. Yeah, that's right. It's just in this week's parasha, in Parashat Bishalach, where it says, "V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim." B'nei Yisrael emerged from Egypt, chamushim. And Rashi on that verse offers two explanations. We, for whatever reason, seem to have a bias towards the Midrashic interpretations of Rashi. I don't know why. I think they're counterproductive educationally. But the Rashi himself offers two interpretations. And there's a reason he offers two. Each one has a strength and each one has a weakness. Whenever Rashi offers two interpretations, especially if one is Midrashic, you can assume that there's a strength and weakness in each interpretation which required two comments, or two interpretations. The challenge is finding what the strength and weakness of each is. So Rashi's first comment is the chamushim means armed. B'nai Yisrael left Egypt armed. They certainly had arms. They fought Amalek at the end of the parasha. They certainly knew how to fight. The second interpretation that Rashi offers there is based on the Medrash, that the word chamushim can also come from the root chamesh, in which Rashi says that one-fifth left Egypt. What does it mean, one-fifth left Egypt? So hence the famous Midrashic comment that four-fifths of Bnei Yisrael died in the plague of darkness. For the record, and I'm on tape, so it is for posterity, I do not take that Midrash literally. I think if you work that Midrash through literally, in terms of the numbers, it doesn't work. Not conceivable. What it means, it's a subject of discussion. But why Rashi brings both interpretations is an interesting issue. After all, the word chamushim in the pshat definitely means armed. No questions asked. The word chamushim has a literal, simple meaning. I don't need the midrashic interpretation. The word chamushim means armed. And you see it used here. There's no alternative interpretation here. Chamushim is the Hebrew term for arms, guns, swords, shields, armor. So why does Rashi jump to the Midrashic suggestion of chamushim? I think in context, there may be other reasons, but one of the reasons is that the context of that verse is to explain why they don't go through Derech Eretz Plishtim. They don't go through Derech Eretz Plishtim, Kikarovu, despite it being the shorter distance, lest they encounter battle. And when they encounter the Plishtim, they'll see war and they'll go run back to Egypt. It's a non sequitur. If they went armed, so on the contrary, if they're armed, then that should be a reason that they should go through Eretz Plishtim. They're protected, they're ready, they're armed, they've got their guns. Why do they need to run if they're going to see battle? So the very word chamushim, there meaning armed, is a reason to explain why they should take that road, not a reason to explain why they shouldn't take that road. So there's a textual challenge there that Rashi chose to address with the Midrash. The Midrash says that v'chamushim means one-fifth, which means that they were decimated spiritually. When decimated spiritually, they weren't ready. They had just recovered from the decimation of one four-fifths of their people. They weren't prepared to engage an enemy in battle. So the Midrashic interpretation in Bishalach helps work through the textual issue there. To understand the pshat, one could interpret the phrase there to mean that despite them being armed and therefore being able to fight militarily, they didn't have the emotional readiness to be able to engage in battle yet. They had just emerged from slavery. So one can look at that verse on two levels. But the word chamoshim in the pshat certainly means armed. My peeve on medrash is that my personal opinion is that I would not be prepared to teach such a medrash unless you're dealing with a group that's old enough and mature enough to be able to work through what the medrash's intent was. But to teach medrash per medrash just for the sake of it, I think has... Yeah, which Rav Nachamali was batty too. Right. It's an old, that's a peeve of mine in education. You're not going to win that debate. That's an old debate on the role of medrash in education. It's an old debate.
But we can assume that midrash is there to fill in the gaps and we're not meant to take it literally. Is that an assumption or not?
The problem with medrash is that there's no one monolithic medrash concept. In other words, there's a Gemara, I have a text called the Talmud. I have a halacha. Halacha has operational rules of how to interpret and how to apply. Medrash is a collection of a myriad of books written and collected over a very long period of time. There is no single monolithic methodology to medrash. There are different books of the medrash, and each one has a different context and when it was written and how it was written, what it was intended to convey, and the methodology of medrash can be different. The same paragraph can be based on one methodology versus another methodology. Some are metaphorical, some are textual, some are historical, some are hysterical. It depends on the context. Medrash needs to be analyzed. Now, there's two issues in medrash. There's the general study of medrash per medrash. Open up a medrash rabba, medrash tanchuma, medrash perkei Rabbi Eliezer. The midrashei agada, there's about, on the Barlang database, I think I counted something like 400 books of midrashei agada. There's also a fundamental difference in between midrash halacha and midrash agada, two different corpuses of Jewish of text. Midrash halacha is all lumped together with medrash, but midrash halacha is the foundation of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's the precursor to the Mishnah. It's the textual analysis that leads to the Mishnah. And it's four books. And only four books. The Mechilta, the Sifrei, the Sifra, and Torat Kohanim. That's it. Midrash Agadah, if I were to start brainstorming all the names of various Midrash Agadah, there would be hundreds. The most famous is Midrash Rabbah. Bereshit Rabbah, Shemot Rabbah, Vayikra Bamidbar, Dvarim Rabbah, Shir HaShirim Rabbah, Kohel, and the Megillot. And you have the Tanchuma, you have Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, you have Mishnat Rabbi Eliezer, you have Avot Rabbi Natan, you have and then you have collections from various time periods. Yalkut Shimoni, which was written in the Middle Ages, but it's a collection of earlier Midrash. So Medrash, to suggest that Medrash has a single methodology is misleading. What is important to recognize is that when Rashi quotes a medrash, the question there is not the intent of the medrash. The question there is the intent of Rashi. That's a different methodological question. In other words, if you have a medrash that's quoted by Rashi in his commentary on the text, considering the fact that Rashi himself tells you in at least three places that his intent is to interpret the text according to the pshat, when Rashi says this can be understood according to its pshat, v'tavar acher, another interpretation can be midrashos according to its midrashic interpretation, then he starts telling you the midrashic context. The question that has to be asked there is, what's Rashi's issue? What is it in the text that led Rashi to this interpretation? Is there a weakness in the pshat that led him to require the midrashic text? That, if you're learning Rashi, that's the question you have to ask. And what I find all too often is that's what's missing in the educational framework. We're not teaching Rashi correctly. That's a curriculum issue related to how we learn Chumash. Less so Parshat Shavua, because nobody learns Rashi textual analysis in Parshat Shavua. But at some point in our study of Chumash, and I'm not sure at what point that should be introduced, but certainly younger than it is being introduced, because as far as I can tell, it's not being introduced until kids go off to Israel and learn yeshiva in Israel. So they don't really get that anywhere in the educational system. And that's not has nothing to do with St. Louis. That's universal. Yeah, you can go to Teaneck and you'll have the same problem. This is an absolutely universal issue. Less so, perhaps, in some of the schools in Israel, depending on the school. And that is that we've lost the skill of how to analyze Rashi. How to go back to the text and try to figure out, okay, what was bothering Rashi? Where is Rashi coming from? What was the question that challenged Rashi? What was he trying to work through in the text? You could spend a lifetime trying to study Rashi. And Nachama Leibowitz did. That was her big contribution in Jewish learning, was opening the door to a critical analysis of the text through Rashi's eyeglass. Nachama Leibowitz. And the schools of learning with Nachama for 3 years. Chumash, 1 year Chumash with Mefarshim, 1 year Chumash with Rashi, 1 year Chumash with Mefarshim, and 1 year Nach. And methodology. Excuse me?
She's one of the women that we do. And we always try and bring someone who learned with us to come and speak.
I'll make you a deal. I'll make you a deal. I'll be happy to come and speak about Nachama, but I'm not prepared to imitate Nachama. I wouldn't do that. I have too much respect for her.
Rashi has that terrible interpretation of killing all the
be careful with words. It's not a terrible interpretation. It's a legitimate interpretation according to a certain school of thought. In other words, Rashi's not alone. There is such an interpretation that is a classic interpretation in the Mefarshim. Somebody said to me afterwards, they were listening to my tape from last week, and they said I was a little too harsh on Rashi. Okay, I will stand corrected. Rashi's interpretation is a legitimate interpretation of the text. We may be uncomfortable with it. That doesn't mean that we reject it. There's another interpretation. Were there not to be an alternative interpretation, that's what we would have to work with. And we'd have to struggle with our own discomfort some other fashion. We have the luxury of being able to fall back on the Rambam and saying, okay, well, we don't paskin like Rashi. Fine. That we don't paskin like Rashi is good for our moral comfort level. That doesn't mean that I reject either Rashi or his Perush because he offered an interpretation that was a little more literal than the one that we did. On the contrary, Rashi's interpretation actually is much closer to the Pshat, much closer to the literal reading of the text than is the Rambam's and the Gemara and the Yerushalmi. So one has to be careful. No, not necessarily. First of all, when it comes to interpretation of text and commentary, we do that all the time. Anytime we look at a text and try to understand it, unless we're studying comparative mefarshim, which is a separate curriculum, right? Unless we're studying comparative commentary, okay, here's a passage, and which we do more in Chumash than we do in Nach, because there's so many more commentaries to be able to work with. So when you study a passage in Chumash, so then you'll do just that. You'll read Rashi, you'll read Ramban, you'll read Ibn Ezra, you'll read Rashbam, and then you'll compare them. And the strengths and weaknesses of one against the other. Now, at some point, is it legitimate to say, okay, which interpretation do I relate to, agree with, connect to some extent with reservations? One has to be careful about halacha components of the Torah before one does that. Because one doesn't have the right to do that in halacha, only in non-halachic interpretation. In Nach, it's more common because there's fewer commentaries. It's a much more open ground. And the general approach with Nach is to try to work through a approach, a mahalach, using the Mefarshim as a guide, but not necessarily a comparative commentary analysis. It's a different methodology. If I was teaching Chumash, I would do it differently. Whereas with Nach, we can say, okay, Rashi's interpretation here, I'm prepared to interpret this according to the Rambam, it works for me better. You can do that enough, less so with Chumash. Anyway, digress into a methodology discussion. But where? In Bishalach?
No, here
in Bishalach
I get it, but you say...
No, here it's easy. Attempt to avnu chamashim lifnei achechem. He's talking to Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh, and he's saying, you have to be the front soldiers. You have to go armed before your brethren. Here it's easy. Here there's no discussion. I understand exactly what it means here. Rashi here doesn't need to say anything because it's clear. Chamashim means armed. There's no discussion. The discussion in Rashi is in Bishalach.
Oh, right, but I thought that we could generalize from there to here.
No, other way around. The Pshat here is clear. So now we can go back to Bishalach and try to understand the word there on the basis of the fact that Chamashim has a clear Pshat meaning. So why Rashi doesn't choose to offer only the pure pshat meaning there, but he offers to a second interpretation, requires us to analyze the text and see, okay, where's the text there leading us, and why does Rashi offer a second interpretation? That would be a methodology in the study of Parsha Bishalach. Here it's very simple. Here he's saying to Reuven God, just to go back to Yoshua for a moment, as long as we can actually stay on the page. Here he's saying to Reuven and Gad, your responsibility is chamushim lifnei achechem, to go armed before your brothers. Now I want to point out an observation about Reuven and Gad that I think we often miss when we learn the story of Reuven and Gad in Parshat Matot. In the story in Chumash, there's a nuance there that we hear, if we are tuned to it, we'd pick up, but we don't see it until here. When Yeshua says to Reuven, Gad, and Menashe, "Vatem tavru chamushim lifnei achechem," he's getting ready to travel to the Yarden. He's ready to cross the Jordan. He's ready to go into the land of Israel. He's bringing all of Bnei Yisrael with him. He just told the Shotrim, prepare the people for a three-day journey. Why does he have to turn to Reuven and Gad and Menashe now? Of all the issues on his agenda, why is the address to Reuven and Gad the first thing on his mind? Before he sends his spies to Jericho, before he plans the crossing of the Jordan, before he does anything, the first item on the agenda, after he sends off the officers to tell everybody to go pack their bags, is he turns to Reuven and Gad. Why? Why them? They've already agreed the part of the whole. They've already made that agreement a long time ago. There's no questions to their loyalty. Why turn to them now? Do we have an indication that they're beta fighters? So I'll show you something. Let's go back to Bamidbar for a moment. I'll show you something very interesting. It's so easy to miss it when we read Parshat Matot because there's so many other things that distract us there. Now the dialogue between Reuven, Gad, and Moshe is a complex dialogue with so many variables that we sometimes lose the focus of what is being addressed. So if you turn to Bamidbar chapter 32. Bamidbar chapter 32. Now, that's a good question. I'll find you. Let's start from the beginning of the parak first. I'll find you the pasuk in a moment. The story begins, Reuven and Gad have much cattle, and they're sitting in Evar HaYarden, which is here. Right, the east side of the Jordan, the land of Sichon and Og. On this map, you can see Reuven and Gad, the territorial. Mm. this shtender is going to kill my Tanakh. It's really not funny. Oh, man. Like, that's really going to help. There's no lip. There's no lip. No, it's all finished. Okay. This territory between the Arnon River and the Yabok River, east of the Jordan, is essentially the land that was conquered from Sichon in Parshat Chukat. That's the territory that Reuben and Gad request. We talked a little bit about this when we talked about Menasheh, right? And they got stuck on the northern part of the Yabok River because that was their territorial, historically their territory. But this part from the Yabok to the Arnon, Reuben and Gad request. They do so here in Bamidbar chapter 32. Mikne Rav haya livnei Reuven uvnei Gad atzuma od. They had a great deal of cattle. Vayiru et eretz Ya'azer v'et eretz Gilad. And they looked at the land of Ya'azer and Gilad, which is essentially this land here, southern part of the of this Gilad and Eretz Ya'azer. And they said, and they saw all the cities. Atrot, Divon, Ya'azer, Nimra, Cheshbon, Elale, Svam, Nevo, Be'on. All list of cities that had been taken from Reuven and from Sichon in this territory here. So they come to Moshe and they make a simple request. We want to stay here. Moshe's initial response is, remember the story? Oh. He wasn't too thrilled. All right, you know what? If you don't remember the story, it's worthwhile reading it through because it really plays a critical role in Yehoshua. So let's read the whole thing through. Starting with verse 5. Vayomru, they said to Moshe, Im matzanu chen be'inecha. Chapter 32. Lamed Bet Hey 32:5. Vayomru im matzanu chen be'inecha. Yutan et ha'aretz hazot la'avadecha la'achuza. If we found favor in your eyes, we want this land as an inheritance. Al ta'avirenu et ha'yardein. Don't take us over the Jordan. We're this is our land. We want to stay here. Vayomer Moshe livnei Gad v'livnei Reuven. Reuven and Gad. Moshe says to Reuven and Gad, Ha'achechem yavou lamilchama va'atem teshvu po? Your brethren are going to go into war and you are going to sit here? Did we do this together? I thought we had done it. Why should you lead Bnei Yisrael astray? Why should you discourage them from going into the land of Israel that God has promised them? He compares them to the spies that discouraged Bnei Yisrael 40 years ago. And he goes to the whole story of the spies and how it led Bnei Yisrael to spend 40 years in the desert with the exception of Kalev and Yehoshua, who were loyal to God. Take a look at verse 14. V'nei kamtem tachat avotechem tarbut anashim chataim. You have come now in place of your forefathers a society of evil sinners. That's a pretty harsh accusation. Lispot od al charon af Hashem Yisrael, to add to God's anger against Israel, ki tishuvun me'acharav v'yosaf od lahanicho b'midbar, that he should again lead you in the leave you in the desert for another 40 years. How dare you? He says to them. Now this paragraph break is very important. I mean, paragraph breaks usually a pause either between speakers or a pause to kind of digest what was just said. So they came to Moshe and they said, Moshe, you misjudge us. We will build barns for our cattle and pens for our cattle. And we will build cities for our children. We will leave our families here. V'anachnu nechalets chushim. Chushim is chamushim. V'anachnu nechalets chushim lifnei b'nei Yisrael. And we will go armed before Bnei Yisrael. Ad asherim v'yunum el-makomam, until we lead them to their place. And then, v'yashav tapenu, during which time, v'yashav tapenu be'areha miftzar mipnei yashvei ha'aretz, we will leave our children in fortified cities so that they will be protected from the local inhabitants. That plan actually was changed. Yeshua changes that plan. He's uncomfortable with leaving the wives and the women and children unprotected. Walled cities have a way of falling. So he ends up splitting the tribes of Reuben and Gad, the army, into three groups. And in any given, on a 3-month cycle or a 4-month cycle, I don't remember, each group served and then went back to protect the rear guard. So we'll see that at the end of Yeshua shifts the plan a little bit. But for now, their offer is, we'll leave all the wives and children, we will go before Bnei Israel, and we will leave them protected. Lo nashuva batenu ad hitnachel Bnei Israel ish nachalato. We give you our word, we will not inherit our land until Bnei Israel have inherited theirs. Which, by the way, takes them 14 years. Right? It takes them 14 years to conquer and inherit the land. Which means that this is a 14-year conscription notice. This is a volunteer service. They signed up for 14 years. All of this because we see our inheritance and our portion here, but we accept the responsibility of going to fight with the brothers first. So Moshe agrees. Tone changes. If you will do this, oh, then you're heroes. If you will go before God in war, and you will go armed in the front before over the Jordan, lifnei Hashem, ad orishu etavav mipanav, until all the enemies are destroyed, v'nichbesha ha'aretz lifnei Hashem, and the land will be conquered before God, v'achar tashuvu v'yitem nekiyim v'yashem Yisrael, and then you will return, then you will be absolved of any guilt and responsibility before God, v'yit ha'aretz hazot lachem l'achuzah lifnei Hashem, then you can take this land. And then he just in case they didn't get the message, he reiterates the message. Ve'im lo ta'asun kein, yinei chatatem la'ashem. But if you don't do this, you're a bunch of sinners. Ude'u chatatchem asher timtza atchem. And know the sin that you are, that is before you. Benu lachem arim letapchem gderot atzona'achem. Build your cities for your children and build your barns and pens and whatever you have for your cattle. What you said, do. So Reuben and Gad respond to Moshe, and they said, we will do exactly as our master instructs. Our children, our wives, our cattle, all of our possessions, you Gilad, we'll leave them here in the land of the Gilad. And your servants will go before God in war as our master has spoken. Now, two observations. One is a classic observation that all the books point out. And the little Medrash says to Nachshon, right? And that's the issue of priorities and sequence. Famous issue, the children love to come home with this from their Divrei Torah on the Parashat Shavua, that when Bnei Yisrael articulated the plan, their plan placed the Gidrot litzonenu before the arim litapenu. If you go back to verse 16, it says, Gidrot tzon nivne limiknenu po v'arim litapenu. We will build place for our cattle and cities for our children. Moshe, when he reiterates the plan in verse 24, he says, Bnu lechem arim litapchem ugderot litzona'achem. You build cities for your children, then you can worry about the cattle. Shift priorities a little bit. So Bnei Gad Uven repeat the plan again in verse 25, only this time, or 26, this time they hear the message, Tapenu nashenu miknenu v'chol b'emtenu. And the sequence being our children, our wives, and then our cattle. So there is a subtle message there in terms of the sequence. priority, lesson in values and priorities in life. When Yehoshua reiterates this plan to Bnei Yisrael, he's very careful to say, Neshechem, tapchem, umiknechem, yeshvu ba'aretz. Sequence is very specific. Your wives, your children, and your cattle. Only difference is that there's a reversal of wives and children. Moshe had the children first, Yeshua has the wives first. If you're already going to make an issue out of the sequence, so you could make an issue out of that too. That's really, to my reading of the text, that's really a secondary, almost this like subtle midrashic nuance there. And it has its place. It's not, however, I think, the primary issue driving this text. The primary issue driving this text, I think we often miss. And it's one word. It's a key word. You know what a milat mancha is? Milat mancha is a concept in textual analysis of Chumash, or of Tanakh, that says, if you look at a particular passage, lahaniach is to lead. A milat mancha is a leading word, a guiding word. It's a word or a phrase that appears over and over and over again, that repeats itself to the point of being a central theme of a passage. So that it's not only the substance of what is being said, but also the cadence, also the nuance of what you're hearing. If you were to look at this passage in the psukim that I just read, and I have no idea how they translate it, so this is going to be hard to do off the translations. But if you look from verse 16 through verse 27, it's 10 psukim. There's one word that appears over and over and over again. Excuse me? Arm only appears once, I think, if it's chushim. Or twice. But there's a word that appears, let me tell you how many times I find it. That's one, right? That's one. That is true. That is definitely a key word here. Not the one that I think connects us to Yehoshua, but certainly a key word. There can be more than one. It can be actually many, and they all usually interrelate. It's part of the exercise. But one, two, three. There's three that I found. I think there's more. Take a look at verse. Say it again. Mechaletz. Mechaletz. Chalutzim. Take a look at verse, starting with verse 17. When it talks about Bnei Reuven and Gad going before Bnei Yisrael, v'anachnu nechaletz chushim. We will go, chushim means armed. What is chalutzim? Nechaletz, which is the verb of chalutzim. We know what modern day chalutz is, right? We know what a modern day chalutz is. The question is, what does the biblical term chalutz mean? And is it related? There's logically, there should be a connection between them. Nechaletz chushim lifnei Hashem. We will nechaletz, armed before God. Whatever that word means, we'll show you in a moment. Then again, in verse 20, Moshe responds and says, Im tasunu tadavar hazeh, im techaltzu lifnei Hashem lamilchama. Doesn't just say if you go to war. He says if techaltzu, in some fashion you'll go to war as chalutz, techaltzu lemilchama. V'yavar lachem, verse 21, v'yavar lachem kol chalutz et hayarden lifnei Hashem. All of you chalutz will go before God over the Jordan. V'nechbesha aretz lifnei Hashem. Then he says it again in verse 27. Vavadacha yavru kol chalutz tzava. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Chavtet again. ויאמר משה להם אם יעבו בני גד ובני ובן אתכם את הירדן כל חלוץ למחמה לפני השם. And in verse 30, ואם לא יעברו חלוצים אתכם. In verse 32, אנחנו נבוא חלוצים. Get the message? Right? You miss it when you read it the first time. Okay? Because we spend so much focus on the sequence of Nashenu, Vitapenu, and Gedivot, right, that we miss the forest of the trees. The real issue here was that Moshe's condition to Bnei Gad u'Bnei Reuven was not that they would go to war with Bnei Yisrael. That was not what Reuven and Gad offered. I don't even think Reuven and Gad entertained the possibility that they wouldn't go to war with Bnei Yisrael. That would be unconscionable. What did they offer? We would go first. They offered to be the Marines. They offered to be the front line. And you know what being the front line in the ancient form of battle was? They offered to remain the front line of Bnei Yisrael for 14 years. Chalutzim lifnei Bnei Yisrael. First, before Bnei Yisrael. We will cross the Jordan, chalutzim, first. We will conquer the land of Canaan, chalutzim, in every battle. Chalutzim, we will be the first. Reuven and Gad are heroes. In the conquest of the land of Canaan, Reuven and Gad are heroes. They are the volunteer front lines of every battle. Why they wanted that particular portion of land is a complex story of the division of the land and the relationship between land and tribe. But it's clear that when Moshe was critical of them, Moshe misunderstood them. Their intent, first of all, was always to cross over the Jordan with Bnei Israel. And second of all, they're prepared, lest there be any question as to their loyalty and to their willingness to fight for the conquest of Canaan, lest there be any accusation that they're doing this for the quote-unquote easy way out, they're prepared to be the frontline Marines in the entire process of the 7 years of the conquest of Canaan and the 7 years of the division of the land by tribes. And that's precisely the role that Yeshua puts them in. If we go back to Yeshua, he's preparing to cross the Jordan. He's getting the tribes ready. For 40 years, the tribes moved in a particular pattern. That pattern placed which tribe first? Anybody know? What was the pattern of how they marched through the desert? They marched through the desert in the pattern of how they were encamped around the Mishkan. Parshat Bamidbar. The whole camp is set out, three tribes on each side of the tabernacle, divided into machanot. A machane, dego machane Reuven, dego machane Yudab, dego machane Ephraim, dego machane Dan. A dego is a banner, a military banner. And a machane is a military camp. They walked through the desert for 40 years in military formation. The Mishkan in the middle, and the tribes grouped in groups of threes. What the significance of that formation was, we'll see later in Sefer Yeshua. It has to do with how they were to actually divide the land of Israel by tribes. The tribal division actually mirrors in some level how the camps were set out in the desert. But in all of their marching through the desert, it was either Reuven, because he was the firstborn, or Yehuda, who was the leader of the tribes. They are now ready to march into the land of Israel. Yehoshua turns to Reuven and Gad, and he reshifts the formation. Right? Up until now, it had been Yehuda first. Now it's going to be, in theory, Reuven first. I'm going to walk into the land of Israel. And he says, "V'laRuveni v'laGadi v'laChatzi Shevet haMenashe." Half of Menashe gets thrown into the same mix for the same reason, even though in the dialogue they weren't part of the plan. But Moshe threw them in, and he says, "Zachor et haDavar sheTzivah etchem Moshe eved Hashem." Remember what Moshe instructed you? Not just that you would go and fight, but rather, נשכם תפרה מקניכם ישו בארץ אשר אני נותן לכם מעבר הירדן ואתם תעברו חמושים לפני אחיכם, כל גיבורי החיל. You will go armed before your brethren. עד שיניח השם לכם ככם. You have to cross the Jordan first. You have to be the chalutzim. And we'll see both when they cross the Jordan and in the Battle of Jericho. Reuven and Gad are described as the chalutzim, the first line. The modern word is connected. The modern term was used in a different context, but it's the same meaning. The modern term chalutz became the farmers, the settlers, the first ones to go and to settle the land of Israel, but to do so because they were first, right? So it's I'm not even sure how to translate the word. How do they translate chalutzim? Pioneers. Pioneers. But a pioneer in innovation and a pioneer in settlement is different than the frontline soldier. The frontline soldier, you wouldn't call him a pioneer. Right? Frontline soldier, you could describe as many other things. Right? Courageous, suicidal, stupid. I mean, you can describe many things. Those who volunteer to be in the front lines in a frontal attack, in the way they used to line up your soldiers and, you know. But that's what they were volunteered to do. Because they were prepared, they did not want to mislead or dishearten the rest of Bnei Israel. Unlikely, because really, I mean, they walked through the land of, they walked through Canaan with very little confrontation. Certainly, in the early stages, Jericho falls barely without firing a shot. Ai is a different battle format altogether. There's very little real opposition to. But we'll talk about that when we get to the strategic and military aspects of the conquest of Canaan. Right. Correct. Right. That's the piece, that's the nuance that I'm suggesting, that Lifnei Achechem here is a reference to the Chalutzim that that Moshe spoke about, and we'll see the term again a few times. It'll be hard to find it now because I have to go through a whole bunch of different places in Chumash, but in the Sefer. But you'll see the two contexts in which I know it appears is both in the context of the conquest of Jericho, as well as in how they crossed the Jordan, where it talks about the Chalutzim before the Aron, and the Chalutzim is always a reference to Reuven and Gad. So we will stop here because we have run out of time. Public service announcement, please note that I am away for the next two Tuesdays. I will be in Israel, visiting my daughter and some of your children as well. So, therefore, we will reconvene here in 3 weeks, I believe February 12th, is it? 11th, 12th? The first, I come back on Thursday, February 7th. February 12th will be our next class. I'll try to send out an email reminder through the school, but that's our next class.